Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
Welcome to New Books in Language. Today I'm talking to Robert Barsky about his biography of Zelig Harris. Barsky describes Harris as a major figure in American intellectual life, sitting in a corner in the middle of the room. In this interview, we discuss some of the ways in which Zelig Harris influenced a generation of thinkers. We consider his role in bringing a scientific ethos to linguistics. And we look at why his contributions, both in the political and language domains, are so persistently overlooked. Robert, you come to this topic having previously written about Noam Chomsky. This isn't a coincidence, is it?
No, not at all. Indeed, when I first approached Noam about doing a book about him, he said that, modestly said, that I should in fact work on Zelig Harris instead, his teacher. That this was a much neglected figure of significant importance, not only to his own work, but to the work of many others. And at the time, my obsession was with Noam Chomsky himself, but I took this to heart and was anxious to, in fact, follow up on the link. First, the link between Noam Chomsky's work and Zelig Harris's work, so that I would properly inform myself about Chomsky's own biography, and then with the eventual intention of pursuing Chomsky's idea and going off into the work of Zelig Harris. I had, as a kind of personal rule, to pursue the things that Chomsky had suggested, since they had always turned out to be extremely fortuitous and interesting.
And the link between them begins right at the beginning of Chomsky's career. But of course, in your biography, you go back further than that into the sort of intellectual environment or milieu in which Zelig Harris was working when he first began his career in linguistics and, for that matter, in politics.
That's absolutely correct. And in fact, it goes back even further. Chomsky's own description of Zelig Harris's influence was one that began at the moment when Chomsky encountered Zelig Harris at the University of Pennsylvania, where he was studying. But as it turns out, Noam Chomsky had been to Zelig Harris's house as a child. And I found interesting relatively close correspondences between some of the interests in Semitics that were manifested by Zelig Harris himself and by Noam Chomsky's father, William. So the intellectual milieu was indeed crucial by the time Chomsky goes to college. But the personal relationships goes back much, much further. As you say, the intellectual milieu into which Chomsky introduces his work is deeply marked by the work of Zelig Harris. And in fact, Harris is considered to be the vanguard in the field. And therefore, that Chomsky undertakes work in linguistics, it is in many ways in response to the kinds of ideas that Zelig Harris was working through at that time at the University of Pennsylvania. As you suggest as well, though, there's also the political milieu and the political interests. And Chomsky says that for him, although he had come to Zelig Harris in a sense in an academic setting, it really was the informal political overlap that he found to be most important, most intriguing, most powerful. And he speaks with tremendous excitement still about those discussions that he had in informal settings with Zelig about the good society and some of the ideas that Harris was working on beyond his academics.
And the balance in your book is reflected in the subtitle, From American Linguistics to Socialist Zionism. Now, of course, it's probably helpful to clarify at this point that though Harris's beliefs are what we call socialist Zionism, this is a long way away from what passes for Zionism in the political discourse of today.
Absolutely. And in fact, that's my current interest, in many ways, is to follow up not only on Zelic Harris as a person, but upon this idea of social Zionism. What's incredibly intriguing as you begin to follow the pathway of Zelic Harris is to discover that he was interested not in what we would now describe Zionism as, which is, for the most part, the support, in a sense, the unquestioning support in many cases of the actions of the Israeli government. But at that time, what Zelic Harris, I think, most interestingly proposes is a socialist Zionism that would be rooted in links and ties between autonomous kibbutzim that would exist in the region that is that was at that time Palestine, that would attract eventually oppressed peoples from around the world, and that would eventually spread in a way that does not reflect our understanding of nations, but rather much more an idea that it would spread and create a socialist region. So the idea is, of course, tied to the a sense of a Jewish homeland. It was, at that time, of unimaginable importance that the Jews find a safe haven. But far beyond that, his idea, Zelic Harris's idea, was to turn this into a region to which oppressed people from around the world would go and find solace and presumably eventually expand that territory. And the role that the Jews would play, in particular the Jews that Zelic Harris was at that time, in a sense, training, if that's the right word, would be as a kind of vanguard. They were trying to work through the particularities of what a region like this might look like, trying to work through the particular forms of governance that would be most appropriate to a multiplicity of peoples from with different backgrounds and so forth. So I think the idea of forming a Jewish vanguard that would eventually go to Palestine is also of tremendous import to the eventual ideas that are promoted here.
Yes, the views that are being exchanged are entirely, as far as one can tell, socially motivated, and not, for example, at all millenarian or religious in their aspect.
That's right.
Is it the case that this group of thinkers are brought together in some sense more by their experience of persecution on account of their ethnic identity?
By the group, you mean the people who were with Zelic Harris, who were interested?
Yes, the members of the movement Avankar, for example.
It's a fascinating question. I think in the first instance, the people are who come to be part of Avukah, for which Zelic Harris is a crucial figure, come together in the first instance socially. That is, they're in college necessarily, because Avukah is a college organization. They come together because they need a place which is appropriate for young Jews to come together in universities that were in many cases somewhat inhospitable. And they came together in the earliest days of Avukah to simply form friendships and relationships and so forth. I think that as time passes, because the group starts in 1925, as time passes, it becomes clear that the obstacles and forces facing young American Jews are increasingly toxic. The rise of fascism in Europe, the possible and eventual, in many ways, what they consider to be the eventual rise of fascism in the United States, made it such that this Avukah group was now going to extend its reach far beyond the social and into the political. So the organization Avukah, eventually under the guidance of people like Rosenberg, but for our purposes, most interestingly, under the guidance and eventual direction of Zelic Harris, is trying to face first the election of Hitler, eventually the rise of World War II, and eventually after that, the involvement of the Americans in World War II. So Avukah, which starts as this, you know, collection of young Zionists who believe in a Jewish homeland, turns into something of profound and I think incredible importance, not only for our understanding of American intellectual history and American social history, but in fact far beyond that. So And as in the late 30s, Zelig plays an increasingly important role in that organization, along with his brother Zvi. The direction that they take is increasingly political, increasingly by a Zionist Organization of America standards, radical, because they advocate, as I said, a kind of socialist region, but they also advocate close ties between Arabs and Jews in Palestine. And this is where I think it becomes incredibly interesting and exciting as a movement. And perhaps we can better understand Zelig Harris and maybe in some ways better understand Noam Chomsky when we consider that the understanding that is described in, say, the Avuka student news of the region is all tied up with the idea that Arabs and Jews in the Palestine area suffer equally on account of forces in society, and that they therefore are better to band against those forces, notably capitalism, imperialism, exploitation. They're better to band against them, to fight them, whether it be British Petroleum or British imperialism or the rise of corporate power, than they are to wage war against each other. And it's at this point, I think, that the figure of Albert Einstein also looms rather large, because Zelig Harris was extremely impassioned by Albert Einstein's work. In my opinion, saw himself in some ways trying to do for linguistics what Albert Einstein had done for physics and particle physics. But Albert Einstein was himself also a Zionist, and himself extremely concerned about questions of Arab-Jewish relations. So Harris, early on, as I indicated in my book, contacts Albert Einstein and invites him into the conversation of Avuka. But then, very interestingly, and I suppose it's one of the strange coincidences of the world, lands up marrying Albert Einstein's personal assistant, Bruria Kaufman. This sounds like kind of a fascinating story of intrigue and connections that way. But in fact, Bruria Kaufman had stayed in the Harris household when she came to America. And Harris, therefore, knew her as his first cousin. So when he sees her in Princeton when Einstein is there and eventually marries her, one could imagine that one of the grand motivations would be to get closer to this figure who he so admired. We might possibly stretch the point and imagine that Zelig Harris was interested in Bruria Kaufman for reasons that extended into her work with Einstein. She was a very, very prominent mathematician, in the same way that somebody might suggest that Noam Chomsky was interested in Zelig Harris purely for his language work, because he knew that work through his father. But in fact, there had been connections in both instances much earlier on. So it's a very interesting and tightly knit community of scholars and thinkers and theorists and political Zionists and so forth, who are described when you enter into the world of Avuka and when you enter into the world of Zelig Harris and his overlaps with Noam Chomsky.
Do you feel that the influence of Avuka in the long run is down to its strength as an organization, or to the confluence of this set of remarkable thinkers in the same circles, in the same environment, or are these inseparable to you?
There are many ways inseparable. One of the things to look at in trying to understand the history of Avuka is not only the organization as it was between the mid-20s and the early 1940s, when it ostensibly dissolves. But it's also probably more significant to look at the individuals who were part of Avuka and what they went on to do. And both of these concerns are now central to my work as I look to extend my understanding of Zelig Harris's milieu into an understanding of the Avuka milieu. So you've got a small organization to which young Jews in the Northeast, originally in Harvard, the Northeast of the United States, were attached and affiliated. this the organization eventually spreads all the way through the United States, or through many universities in the United States, right up into Canada, the University of Toronto and University of Manitoba and McGill. So the organization itself, which has this Zionist interest, which has interest in Arab-Jewish relations, which has interest in some ways Jewish cultural affairs, but not religious for the most part, has or attracts a series of young and remarkable individuals. And it is now my project to interview the surviving members of that organization to talk about the role that that organization played for them as they formed their ideas and worked through the many professions that they landed up engaged in through their lives. So my work now involves interviewing people who are as different ideologically as, well, originally was Seymour Melman, who's now passed away, and Nathan Glazer, or Robert and Judith Wallerstein, Irene and Zev Schumer, Chava Rapkin, people who now come to political ideas from quite different standpoints and have pursued very different careers, but who have this amazing common link, this common tie through this Zionist student organization, AVUCA. So I think your question is very apropos. It is on the one hand an intellectual organization, on another a social organization. These come to be deeply intertwined. And at some level, I guess you could ask the impossible question, which would be, how did AVUCA shape each of these individuals? What role did this organization play for all of them? It's impossible in the sense that it's hard to know 70 years later, as I'm asking these questions of people, you know, what they specifically learned from AVUCA. But Judith Wallerstein, for example, told me that she went to university and she went to AVUCA simultaneously, and she learned most of what she knows from AVUCA. So I thought that was a beautiful and very telling statement.
Indeed. A question related to that you touch upon in your book on Harris is the dissolution of AVUCA, which sounds like itself rather a curious story with rather unexpected interpersonal, maybe even power dynamics.
Absolutely. And it's a microcosm. It's a microcosmic story, if I can use that term, that represents a much broader set of phenomena. So the story is that AVUCA becomes increasingly influenced by the New York office, by the work that's done in New York and Philadelphia, inspired in many ways by the work and the ideas, in particular the political ideas of Zelig Harris and the people who were closest to him. But with the World War II and the eventual involvement of Americans in World War II, Zelig Harris becomes extremely concerned about keeping the vanguard of the AVUCA group out of the war in order to continue the work towards establishing socialist utopia in Palestine. So that in itself, I think, is kind of a mind-boggling thing to say. And of, you know, tremendous, I think, importance for understanding that period. And he did so in part by involving people in his language studies. So he gets people to be part of research projects that are eventually aimed towards teaching, for example, soldiers foreign languages quickly and effectively and efficiently using techniques that were being developed at that time in linguistics. So this is the plan. You've got a vanguard group, in particular out of the New York office. You've got Zelig Harris, who believes that, in a sense, the war between the Allies and the Axis powers is ultimately a war, an imperialist war, a capitalist war, and that the much broader, more significant objective should be to advance the cause of socialism, as he understood it, beginning in the Palestine region. And the organization is moving in this direction. However, of course, we're talking here about individuals, probably up to around 2,000 individuals in Avuka. Not everybody shared all of these objectives, and certainly the people outside of the New York office, or certainly the people outside of the Northeast, saw the Avuka group quite differently. Even the Boston group has been described to me as having different objectives and motivations. But the head office being in New York meant that as some of the men were recruited and went off to war, and this includes, for example, the very crucial figure of Seymour Melman, there is a growing role that women play in the organization. And this is another fascinating part of the story, that the Shoshana Harris, Ruth eventually Glazer, eventually Gay, Irene Schumer, play increasingly powerful roles in the New York office. And their conception is that the role that Avuka should play is not so much a utopian or utopian-oriented role of establishing socialist Zionism in Palestine, but rather rescuing the Jews from the clenches of Nazis by liberating the camps and so forth and so on. The story of the dissolution of Avuka is wrapped up in the question of how strongly the group surrounding Zelig Harris reacted to this idea. And it has been suggested to me variously that one of the things that happened to Avuka was that Zelig Harris, who was ultimately behind it all, believed the organization was going to fall into a completely different paradigm of work, that as in particular these very powerful, very brilliant women were taking the helm of Avuka, that it would change directions. And he advocated for its dissolution, which happens in a summer camp. It seems to be in 1943. And the people behind this dissolution include, at this time, Nathan Glazer. And he says that he was at some level part of a kind of cabal into which he had brought Seymour Martin Lipset. But behind this idea was ultimately the Zelig Harris and Nathan Glazer. So you've got this image of a vanguard organization whose direction is looking to be changed. The refusal or the rejection of this conception by the vanguards of the organization, the sort of directors of the organization, and its subsequent dissolution. This conception is not agreed to by everybody. And as I said, I've been interviewing surviving members, and some of them say that with the war, it became obvious that Avuka's role was going to shift, that it was going to change and perhaps dissolve, or else it became perhaps more appropriate to meld Avuka into the broader objectives of the Zionist Organization of America, and that it was in fact the Zionist Organization of America and the broader organization, Jewish organizations, who believed that Avuka was somewhat renegade, smaller renegade organization, somewhat overly radical for its own good. And it was this that was behind the ultimate dissolution. And that's actually what Seymour Melman told me before his death, that that it really was the radicalness of the organization rather than the vanguards dissolving it. But as you say, it's a fascinating story. But it has broader implications than just the dissolution of a small Zionist student organization somewhere in America. It captures in some ways, or this dissolution captures some of the really important forces that are at work during the war.
A point that you also make is that then, as at other times, Zelig Harris was particularly concerned about the possibility of allowing his name to be openly associated with these radical ideas.
Yes.
Which is possibly quite understandable in the light of the way in which an organization which wasn't wholly in support of Allied objectives in the war would be regarded at that time.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. Yeah, sorry.
No, I just wondered how you How do you feel that developed throughout his political career?
Well, Zelig Harris is a particularly strong example of this. As you know, nothing political, none of his political writings emerged during his own lifetime. It's only a group of people, Bill Evan and Marie Eden and Seymour Melman, who helped to bring out the transformation of capitalist society subsequent to his death. So he was perhaps an extreme example of very vast feeling Jews, I think in particular left-wing Jews, that it was dangerous to promote the kinds of ideas that they had publicly, and that there was a real risk involved in having their names associated with political activities of this sort. So, yes, that's a gigantic consequence. And in fact, Nathan Glazer told me that this was also true of a number of the Frankfurt School writers, that much of their dialectics, which we in the university always think of as being appropriately complex for the appropriately complicated ideas that they were addressing, he says also that there is some measure of them rendering dialectical ideas that were likely to get them into trouble. So that the complex language of an or a Horkheimer is not just fascinating in dialectical prose, it's also in some ways hiding your intentions. But as I said, in the case of Zelig Harris, it's of gigantic importance because he works in the university. He is developing what he believes will be the template for an eventual communications program or project through his structural linguistics and his efforts in those directions that will be of extreme consequence to the emerging communications, and computer industries. So Zelig Harris's work is being funded by the military, in addition to being funded by the NSF. His work seems to have gigantic consequences for work like simultaneous translation, content analysis, and the eventual, what we now know to be the eventual digitization of language and so forth, that he's on the forefront of research that will be of tremendous importance to all aspects of communications, including coding, decoding, and the military. So that's one side. The other side is that he's has this interest in socialist utopia and Zionism and is Jewish and comes from what would be deemed to be a radical background. For him, as many, many others, it was therefore necessary to separate the two worlds quite carefully. And he worked on a huge project about which very little is now known. And part of the reason for my writing the book was to try to understand this huge project called the Project on the Frame of Reference. The Frame of Reference project was specifically aimed towards helping us understand the frame through which people understand their realities, helping us understand the paradigm that directs our conception of how the world functions and works and so forth. And the eventual objective of this transformation, this work on frame of reference, is to transform, say, workers' relationship to their workplace, to promote ideas of, for example, worker involvement in decision making, and eventually worker takeover of factories, eventually towards this, once again, this idea of a socialist utopia. So you've got a very, very broad and ambitious project under the form of this idea of frameworks that he works on. But he works on it secretly, and he works on it with a small group of people who work on very particular sections of each of these of each of the questions that are posed under the auspices of such a huge plan, with the eventual objective of producing a kind of Das Kapital for the present world. So, but he doesn't release any of the findings of this group during his lifetime, none of it, which from my interviews and so forth seems to have infuriated a number of people who would have liked to have, you know, I guess participated more directly in conversations of the time. But he keeps it quiet, I think for two reasons. One of them, the reason that your question indicates, is extremely dangerous in his conception to actively demonstrate these interests. The second is because Harris has, I think, an idea that you don't sort of promote a conversation that's not entirely done yet. I have the conception of Harris as working carefully and systematically and so forth on grand questions with the idea of coming up with the answer to that question and then sending it out there. There's a sense that's been conveyed to me that from his perspective, it was irresponsible to say involve yourself in a kind of scientific socialism until you'd answered the questions that it involves so that you can present a fully baked plan to the world. So those are two possible explanations, and maybe it's a little bit of both.
It's an interesting consequence then that when the work is published posthumously as The Transformation of Capitalist Society, as you point out, it receives very little attention.
Yes. Yeah, it is. It's ironic. It's tragic, I think, because it's a very interesting book, and maybe not in itself. Maybe the book itself feels very dated. But it's interesting because it does talk about some very interesting and positive potential ways of dealing with these questions. For example, he talks at some length about the Mondragons in Spain. He talked in the Basque region. He proposes and talks about a series of alternatives to capitalist society, which are, for I think the current generation, depending upon the region in which you live, relatively unknown. But he does, and furthermore, the book is not really that grand pronouncement that you're kind of, that one may have expected would have come out of all this research. At the end of the day, it is not a clear articulation of an alternative to capitalist society. Maybe more interesting though, and maybe most interesting in all of what we've been talking about together, is the residues of these ideas that were passed on to other people. And here I'm thinking, for example, of Seymour Melman. Melman, who in many ways became the torchbearer for ideas that were political ideas that were promoted by Selig Harris's society. And his work on the transformation of capitalist society, his work on War Inc., his work on Pentagon capitalism and so forth, all I think bears a very strong trace of things that he learned about workers' councils, about ESOPs and so forth from Selig Harris. So you're right. The work of Selig Harris, the political work, passed with nary a mention. Interestingly, the late work of Seymour Melman also passed with nary a mention, but maybe in that case it was because his final book came out just after 9/11. The world's gaze shifted differently, and the things that he was proposing in his final work became increasingly untenable for the modern world.
With respect to the late Harris work, I get the impression that you were arguing in your description of it that in some sense its day may not have come yet. And as much as this was not necessarily a program for revolutionary radical change, but rather a description, among other things, of the ways in which a post-capitalist society might begin to resolve that problem of the distance between the workers and the production ownership and so on.
That's a fantastically interesting analysis. And I think it goes to a really central issue here. If it is the case that Marx's work seems or is incredibly dated and does not seem applicable to the world, if it is the case that those tendencies that are described in Seymour Melman's work or in Selig Harris's work don't have the currency that one might expect them to have, even in the face of, you know, the obvious failures of capitalism on a number of fronts. And perhaps it is pointing towards a distant future or a near future when workers will be more, will develop a firmer understanding of where their interests truly lie, and that therefore the book may, we may dust it off at some point the way we might dust off Anton Panikuk's work on workers' council someday, and find in there some hidden nuggets. The problem is, and this is where I think Noam Chomsky and Zelig Harris are looking at or trying to capture the same set of issues, or try to understand the same set of issues. The crucial question becomes one of attitudes. How do you modify people's attitudes about their workplace? How do you direct people's focus towards their own best interest? How do you convey to people that this system is broken, and that there are ways and perhaps even paradigms out there that would allow them to better understand their situation? That's a really interesting question. And it's a really interesting question in the era of the manufacturing consent. So here you can see that I feel that in some ways, some of these questions about attitudes that Harris was very interested in from a psychoanalytic perspective and other perspectives that are named in the work on frame of reference come to hook up with Chomsky's work on propaganda in the current era. The problem is that one of Chomsky's conclusions, which is kind of evident from the current election campaign, say in the United States, is that people's attitudes can be manufactured. That when Romney pours more money into a state, that votes fall. You can engage in gigantic advertising campaigns and create desires in people that they don't actually, say, naturally have. That in fact, there's a really pessimistic side to all this, which would suggest that our revelation that we might have someday that the current system does not address our interests or needs, that might lead us back to, say, Zelig Harris's work, is destined for failure because the advertising campaigns, the media, the you know, owned by large corporate interests, is capable of shaping public opinion in incredible ways. So I think that Zelig Harris's work is premised on the idea that we are ultimately rational beings, or and that, you know, that yes, we're swayed by consumer desires, or yes, we're swayed by power and relations in public, but that at some point we can be made more clear about where our interests truly lie. There's some hope out there. Well, maybe that's not true. Maybe gigantic propaganda campaigns are sufficiently powerful and manage to tap into decision making in ways that make the eventual objectives that Zelig Harris aims unattainable. That's a really important and frightening question, I think.
It's interesting you bring it up, because there were a few times in your book where I felt that you were making the point that there was maybe not exactly a deficiency, but a difficulty that Zelig Harris sometimes had in understanding people's irrational motivations, if you like.
Yeah.
And that sometimes manifested itself at a personal level, and sometimes maybe was influential in the ideology. I'm thinking, for example, of the matter of the cooperation between Jewish immigrants and the Arab natives in Palestine.
Right.
That from a sort of Marxist class-based analysis, there should be cooperation because it would be in everybody's interests, and those are they have more in common than separates them.
Right.
But that was not necessarily what people on the ground would actually think.
Right.
For, if you like, purely irrational reasons.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. He is, as you suggest, described by many people who knew him well as cold, as calculating, as rational, maybe overly rational, maybe expecting that people should be concerned or would be concerned with the things that concern him because of this idea that we are all ultimately not irrational beings, that we all share certain concerns. But you're right. He perhaps doesn't contend well with irrationality. He doesn't contend well with, I would argue that even our artistic sides, even some of the strange ideas that we might come up with are really not part of what we know to have been his interest. And so too it is the case that he's often described as having a lack of personal warmth, that there's not an entre-gens between him and others, with a relatively few small exceptions, and that this perhaps is an impediment towards his sharing of these ideas. I think of this, again, is unbelievably fascinating if you consider it relative to Noam Chomsky, his student. Chomsky, who has in his public persona a way of drawing crowds together to contemplate complex issues that concern with an incredible degree of enthusiasm, that even though Chomsky's work is so based on rational ideas and notions of clearly working through conceptions and so forth, there is also, and nonetheless, a wittiness in his writing, a clarity in his writing. There's a joy in the same way that one might read with joy what Orwell wrote. There's a joy in reading Chomsky's examples. There's a joy in reading his prose. He is, from his first collection of essays all the way forward, incredibly witty and charismatic in his writing. None of this is present in Harris writing. Some of the dullest books ever written, in the scientific side. And his political book is not a heck of a lot more filled with sparkles. So, there's the belief that you can somehow use just pure ideas in a pure realm in order to shape the course of history. Perhaps that's not true. Perhaps in an age of the manufacture of consent, perhaps in an age of powerful interests which use huge media campaigns and so forth, perhaps that just doesn't work. So yeah, I think your question is fascinating. It goes to some really crucial questions about the distance that one might have to travel, even if one had those answers that Harris seemed to be searching for.
And it brings us back rather neatly to the question of the influence of Einstein in particular and theoretical physics in general on Harris's approach to his linguistic work.
Yes.
I get the impression that he had rather mixed feelings about the success of the enterprise of applying the scientific method in linguistics. He's reported as having little regard for anything that isn't really proper hard sciences. Subsequently, maybe unrelatedly, encouraging people away from linguistics because all the interesting work there is done.
Right.
Does that reflect a sort of modesty that is remarked upon by others, dissatisfaction with his own work, or just a very cold, rational assessment of how things are?
I think it's a cold, rational assessment of how things are. That's a very good description. But it is also the case, as you mentioned, and I love that comment as well. And it's, I had originally heard that comment from Chomsky. Chomsky had originally told me that when he spoke to Zelig Harris, that Harris said that linguistics as a field would not last that much longer, that he was working to solve the problems of linguistics once and for all, and that would end the field. And he really had the conception that, as you say, like his mentor, or the person he would have liked to have seen as his mentor, Albert Einstein, that somehow there'd be some set of formulas that would allow us to ultimately create the basis for a solid computational linguistics, and that, to quote Chomsky, that the field was eventually essentially over, that he has had a few I's to dot and T's to cross, but that was the end of it. I heard exactly the same story from Zelig Harris's nephew, Ted Liv, who wanted to go into linguistics, and he went and sought out his uncle, and he said, well, should I go and study linguistics? And he said ostensibly the same thing to him. So this really was something that he seems to have believed. But let's take the contrast between him and Einstein. Einstein is working in a very directed way in particle physics and so forth, working, as I said, with Maria Kaufman from a mathematical perspective, trying to solve these incredibly complex and rich problems. Never, you know, ultimately follows and finishes the broad set of questions that he had set for himself. I guess you could say the same thing for Zelig Harris. There's certainly a line of people now who believe that Harris's work is still extremely important as pioneering work for increasingly successful computational linguistics, which many people believe to be far more successful in its own terms than Noam Chomsky describes it as. But let's take the contrast a little further. Look at the difference between Einstein and Harris in the political realm. As you know, Einstein's political aphorisms and his public persona are very well known by the public. He could come down from the Mount Princeton, utter these powerful statements with great wisdom and insight, and people read them and they put them on posters and so forth and so on. In the political realm, obviously that's not the case with Zelig Harris. So I think your question is fascinating, both from the scientific linguistic side, but also from the scientific social side, the social side of trying to understand social engineering, or trying to understand questions of promoting different attitudes amongst workers and so forth towards their workplace.
When you talk about the idea of an intellectual coming down from the mountain, so to speak,
yes,
it reminds me of something that Noam Chomsky says in your interview with him for your book.
Yes.
Where he suggests that Zelig Harris had a fear of his own power to influence people.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, and Chomsky uses as an example his meeting of Nathan Glaser, which I actually have as part of this new film that I'm making, this new documentary film. He mentions it, that when he first met Nathan Glaser in the 60s, he talked to him for just a few minutes, and then he asked him, you know, Zelig Harris, and Nathan Glaser said yes, and he said, why do you ask? And Chomsky said, well, you know, no reason, but the reason why was because he imitated all of his mannerisms and his gestures and gesticulations and so forth. In other words, that his personality was extremely powerful, and that he had, and he really did, of course, have tremendous influence upon extremely brilliant people. So yes, his power to articulate ideas, his power to enthrall people with his somewhat utopian, always scientific ideas and approaches is clear, and it was a clear influence on Chomsky. It was a clear influence on a huge array of others who came to work with Zelig Harris, either in the linguistic or in the political realms. So yeah, he may have had more power than he was even willing to admit.
I'd like to ask you about Harris's later linguistic work in very broad brush terms. It exhibited, would it be fair to say, a certain indifference to contemporary trends in the field?
Yes, it did. And in particular, you know, contemporary trends in the field turned into Noam Chomsky. So Zelig Harris's most renowned student went on to revolutionize the field. And yet Chomsky did not say a heck of a lot about Harris's work in his own linguistic writings, because he really does go off in different directions. And Harris doesn't say anything about Noam Chomsky's paradigm that he develops in his later work. So there is the conception of there being an indifference to Chomsky's work, which, as you know, spread all the way through the world eventually. So that's one side of it. The other side of it is that the claim, and here I'd like to draw upon the NSF's own assessments of Zelig Harris's later work. In the NSF's very complex and elaborate analyses of Zelig Harris's later project, there is the claim that he is out of touch with the field, that he is insulated himself with a small number of people at the University of Pennsylvania, that he works in a very specific and increasingly dated paradigm and so forth. And this becomes a critique of some of his later projects. So whereas, as I mentioned, in say in the 40s, 50s, there is the belief that Zelig-Harris is maybe not going to solve all the problems of linguistics, but certainly on the forefront of the most important work. By the later assessments, and here I really want to rely on the assessments because it was his contemporaries who were saying this, in the later assessments of his projects, they're saying, you know, he's not up on other works in the field. He's increasingly isolated, and he's pursuing his own work. Well, if you talk to those people who are interested still in Zelig-Harris's paradigm, what they would say is that the paradigm itself posed sufficiently complex questions that Harris doggedly pursued, that it was appropriate for him to continue working in that direction, and that once again, there's a richness in the substance of what he ultimately produces. So it kind of depends on which side of the fence you're on in terms of language theory as to what the lingering importance of Zelig-Harris's work is. I do have an interesting anecdote, though. I met with computational linguist who works at the Vanderbilt University Hospital, and he told me that as they're trying to code, say, symptoms as described by patients so that they can be compared with similar symptoms in other patients, not only in that hospital but across the world, that many of the methods that they would use would have emerged from a kind of a Zelig-Harris paradigm, so that it's not in fact just moribund as a notion, but it does usefully serve a purpose. And, you know, maybe not surprisingly in the medical field, as Harris had taken examples from the medical field because of his brother's own involvement in medicine, his brother Zvi's own involvement in medicine, which provided him with a corpus.
Yes, it seems curiously ironic that there's a, as Harris's work is being judged comparatively irrelevant, at the same time, through the ages, there's an upsurge in work which is derived indirectly from his own initial researches.
Yes.
But in which he's not, he doesn't care to engage in that, doesn't care to be sort of actively a patriarch to this these fields.
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, he didn't live to see you know, the current resurgence and the incredible growth of, say, computational linguistics. And maybe the challenges that are being posed to the Chomskyan paradigm now, valid or not. So no, he did not live. And I think the verdict is still out. At the MIT anniversary celebration, there was this question of what direction science is taking, and Chomsky very adamantly said that a broadly described as a computational approach is deeply limited in terms of actual knowledge, that it may work as an engineering project might work to solve certain, not solve certain types of problems, but address certain types of needs that we have, but that it doesn't get at the deeper questions that are being posed. Chomsky would still, of course, say that about Harris's work, that it and in fact, Chomsky never really displays an interest, lingering interest in Harris's paradigm at all. That you know, as he describes it, he goes off in a different direction from his student days forward, and you know, really does not ascertain there to be a serious lingering importance, even though others may suggest that there is.
Well, it's been fascinating talking to you about these subjects. Our time is quite nearly up, but I must ask you about your current project.
Thank you. Yes. I couldn't be more excited about this. The way that it started was that, and it's unbelievably sad to say this, but the way that it started was that as I tried to better understand Zelig-Harris, I would go to speak with and interview his students, beginning in the early days with Seymour Melman, but extending out to Murray Eden and Meyer Raban. For example, in fact, I had the meeting with the three of them in New York City in the 90s. two of those three people have now passed away, and I took notes during that meeting and then deeply regretted that I hadn't recorded it. So in later interviews, I began to start recording people, even though I had this resistance towards being this intrusive. And then eventually, I particularly recall a meeting that I had with Seymour Melman in New York City, in which he was losing his office at Columbia, and he was being emptied out of his office, and he was describing that the period that I was interested in, and he actually, he was in his 80s, I guess late 80s by then. He stood up on his steel desk in front of me in this empty office on a hot day, New York City at Columbia University, in a basement of the industrial engineering building. He stood up on his desk and waved his arms around and told me incredibly sad stories about what had happened in the periods that he was recalling. And I thought, you know, only I will witness this. So I started thinking that I should begin to film. And just for purely documentary reasons, really just to document what I was doing, I began to carry, in a very amateurish way, borrowed equipment around and just stick it on a tripod and interview people. And I've now become, the term is wrong, but addicted to watching these figures describe their lives, describe them. It's unbelievably fascinating. And I realized that I had something here that was so incredibly inspiring, interesting, that I went for a grant and asked for monies to return to interview former members of Avuca, for them to reminisce not just about Zelig Harris, but about Avuca and in many ways their own lives, which I'm now filming and creating a documentary film about this milieu. My original thought was that it would be the story of Avuca, but it has turned out to be, in a sense, more interesting to describe the story of young people who get together with ideals and dreams and hopes and utopian worlds in their minds, and who, against the dominant paradigm of their parents, create new avenues for exploration. And in a sense, that's a story that's being told in the interviews that I've been doing. It's not just about the, you know, a homeland for Jews in Palestine. It's not just about socialist utopia. It's not just about the kibbutzim and the possible, you know, spread of the kibbutzim as a concept of social organization. It's about young people who get together and who love each other and who care about each other and who respect one another's opinions, and who try to articulate a vision that makes sense for the future. And so my interviews, which now I guess I have about almost two dozen, are just resonate with these incredible themes. And fascinatingly enough, a number of the people I interviewed are married to people they met out of the meetings, you know, in the 1930s and 40s. We're talking about people here who are, you know, in their 90s. In fact, I even met Zelig Harris's brother, who's over 100. So, dealing here with people whose reminiscences go right back to the time when they met their still current spouses at Avuca meetings in the 1930s and early 1940s. It's incredibly powerful stuff.
Well, it sounds like an absolutely fascinating project, and I look forward to hearing about it when it's brought to fruition.
Thank you so much.
And thank you again for your time here in the interview.
It's been my pleasure.
I've been talking to Robert Barsky about his book, Zelig Harris, From American Linguistics to Socialist Zionism. This is Chris Cummins for New Books in Language, saying thanks for listening.